And thanks.
There goes the sun, Mr. Pat Donahue. Thank you, Pat. When you grow up with the name Calvin in Kansas City, Missouri, people do have expectations of you, but they didn't call you that back there. They called you Buddy.
That's right.
Yeah, you were Bud back there. No, you wouldn't call somebody Calvin just right out.
No, they were willing to name me Calvin, but not call me Calvin. Right.
They had high ambitions for him. He went off to Yale. Son of a grocer went off to Yale. So he fulfilled your father's dream for you.
Right.
You went off and became an All-American football or no?
I didn't make the first All-American team. I don't want to mislead you.
No. Right. Okay. Okay. Well, we can cover that later in a footnote, surely.
Right.
Went off to serve in the Army back when writers did that.
That's right.
Went to work for Time Magazine and then for The New Yorker, and now has reached his pinnacle as a deadline poet for The Nation magazine, America's premier far-left magazine.
Right.
And he's there.
Right.
Written books along the way. Messages from My Father is one of my favorites. And one of the greatest parking novels ever. Tepper Isn't Going Out.
Thank you. I'm not here to boast, Garrison, but it was the first parking novel. Nobody had ever written a parking novel
Nobody
before.
Dares to attempt to write a novel about parking.
There has not been a bandwagon effect from
no,
that novel.
No, no. And now with a brand new book with the interesting title, Quite Enough, of Calvin Trillin.
Right. That's right.
Sit down, Mr. Trillin.
Okay,
that's
thanks
quite
enough.
Enough.
That's right.
So, Missouri. Kansas City.
Kansas City, Missouri.
Yes. Over there on the other side of the state.
The other side of the state from St. Louis.
Right. Okay.
Formerly the gateway to the West.
Right. We just want to get people's geography clear in their minds. That's near Minnesota, right? Missouri?
People from Minnesota aspire to Kansas City. For an Authors Guild benefit some years ago, four or five of us were asked to write a rejection letter turning down some classic work of literature. Garrison Keillor rejected Walden Pond by Henry David Thoreau. He said that Walden Pond had a lot of good axioms in it, but that the structure was weak, so he suggested turning it into a calendar. I rejected The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot. I rejected it in iambic pentameter, of course. The last couplet of my letter was, I know this is a blow, Tom, not to worry. You're still the greatest poet from Missouri. The faintness of praise in calling someone the greatest poet from Missouri can be gauged by the fact that the other poet from Missouri is me. Another way to put it is that T.S. Eliot and I comprise the Missouri School of Poetry. I know you're thinking that there are considerable differences between T.S. Eliot and me. It's true that he was from St. Louis, which started calling itself the Gateway to the West after the Gateway Arch was erected, and I'm from Kansas City, where people think of St. Louis not as the Gateway to the West, but as the exit from the East. But then there are the similarities. For instance, both of us have a penchant for using foreign languages in our poetry. Eliot likes to use Sanskrit. The last line of The Wasteland is Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. I've never used Sanskrit in a poem myself. I go in more for Yiddish. I think it's fair to say that Eliot was not partial to Yiddish. My shortest poem, called The Sociological, Political, and Psychological Implications of the O.J. Simpson Case, was in its entirety O.J., oy vey. And we both have occasionally written about animals. Eliot famously wrote a series of poems about cats, and I have written, for example, that corgis appear to be a breed of dog assembled from the parts of other breeds of dog, and not the parts that those other breeds were all that sorry about giving up. As a matter of perspective, I should acknowledge that there has never been a long-run Broadway musical called Corgis. Our paths do separate dramatically on the matter of rhyme. Unlike Eliot, I have stuck stubbornly to rhyme. That might have something to do with the poetic influence of my father. He was a grocer for most of his working life, but he owned a restaurant for a while, and he treated that as an opportunity to put a rhyming couplet on the menu every day at lunch, often about pie. He rhymed pie with shy and July, evening is nigh, and all right, warden, I'm ready to fry, my last request was Mrs. Trillin's pie. My favorite of his menu poems was, "Eat your food," gently said Mom to her little son, Roddy. "If you don't, I will break every bone in your body." The sort of poetry I do on current events every week, deadline poetry, is of course sneered at by what I think of as the Sanskrit crowd. People who, I must point out, never faced a deadline themselves. Take Eliot, for instance. And I'm not here to knock the competition. But take Eliot, for instance. If he didn't think February was truly the cruelest month, and March seemed only cruel-ish, he could wait around for a month that really struck him as a total bummer. Also, he could choose the words he wanted to rhyme. Deadline poets are stuck with writing about people in public life, and there are people who persist in going into public life despite the fact that their names are impossible to rhyme. The presidency has been a particular problem. Bush was a terrible rhyme. Fortunately, George H.W. Bush had plenty of middle names to use. So when he left the White House, I wrote, "Adieu to you, George Herbert Walker. Though never treasured as a talker, your predicates were often prone to wander nounless off alone. You did your best in your own way, the way of Greenwich Country Day. So just relax and take your ease and never order Japanese." Clinton was even worse. Clinton is the orange of American presidents. In his second term, right at the beginning of the unpleasantness, it was said that Hillary Clinton was going on the Today program to lead the defense. I had to use what in past days we would have called her maiden name, what would now be called maybe her name of origin, her slave name. And so it's up to our Miss Rodham to prove Bill's White House isn't Sodom. It's left to this adroit senora to show that it is just Gomorrah. When the current presidential campaign got underway, I got my hopes up. Perry rhymes with so much, like the space between his ears, some say, is airy. Then, of course, Perry sank like a stone in the polls. For a while, I put my hopes on Herman Cain, though thinking voters might ordain for Cain a 4-year White House reign is truly, to be blunt, insane. Now the people who pontificate on Sunday morning TV shows from Washington, the people I call the Sabbath gas bags, tell us that we'll probably have a Romney-Obama campaign. This is crushing news for a deadline poet. I'm likely to be stuck with two candidates whose rhymes were used up in 2008. Actually, even before 2008, I'd used up all of the Obama rhymes on Osama bin Laden. Yokohama, Cinerama, slap your mama. And I found nothing fresh to say about Mitt Romney since the poem I wrote during the 2008 campaign. Yes, Mitt's so slick of speech and slick of garb, he reminds us all of Ken, and Barbie. So quick to shed his moderate regalia, he may, like Ken, be lacking genitalia. Uh, I'm now beginning to wonder whether, as a boy in Kansas City, I should have paid a little more attention in Sanskrit class. When T.S. Eliot lacked inspiration, he could just go out and find himself another cat. Shanti, Shanti, Shanti.